Hello and welcome to another episode of On My Last Eggs. I'm Rachel, and like millions of other women worldwide, I'm navigating the wild throes of perimenopause.
Basically, the more we talk about something, the more we normalise it. When I was growing up, my mum would say with pride, your dad doesn't even know when you both are having periods. That's not something to be proud of, because you're then actually struggling.
I'll be lifting the lid on what that whole messy, confusing journey entails, with plenty of lols and some WTFs along the way.
And I think for me to cope myself is to not get overwhelmed with it, but keep making small changes. It's far less about doing what your friend is doing and more about listening to your body and seeing how you are.
Welcome to this episode of On My Last Eggs. Dr. Radhika Vora, who's a private and NHS general practitioner with an interest in women's health and menopause care and a trustee medical advisor at the menopause charity. Radhika, welcome. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you on. I can't help but notice you're a very vocal and active voice in the menopause landscape at the moment. And there's lots of things I want to chat to you about quite generally with menopause and specifically with some of the work you're doing. But the thing that really brought my attention to you and one of the reasons we really wanted to have you on the podcast is the disparity when it comes to menopause support and help out there for women, or at least maybe not the disparity in the support and help, but the disparity in the prescription rate and the treatment for things like HRT between ethnic minorities and white people. So basically, there was an article in the Independent newspaper that said in areas where GP practices predominantly have a high proportion of ethnic minority patients compared to areas where they have a high proportion of white patients, there's just this huge disparity. So you've got more than four times as much money being spent on prescribing HRT in the predominantly white areas to the areas which are predominantly non-white. And So let's crack on with that straight away. I'm always blown away, shocked and horrified by the disparities in things when it comes to women's healthcare generally. And then this, I'm like, that's mad. That's not a bit of a difference. That's huge, isn't it?
It is. It's enormous. And I think it's really interesting and important that we're drawing attention to this and looking into why this might be happening. There's lots of gaps in women's health, like you say, and particularly research in women's health and menopause is limited, but it's even more limited on women from different backgrounds. So we have to draw conclusions from what we experience in anecdotal cases, but also via experience. And there's becoming more descriptive information and papers coming out. So definitely talking about this and making some noise is making a difference. The biggest difference it's going to make is going to make women from different backgrounds and of colour listen and realise menopause is important for them. Because we went through a phase where actually menopause appeared like something that affected white women and it didn't affect women of colour. And all the other problems they had were separate from menopause. And all the other problems are so big that menopause sort of drowns in the background. So one of the biggest things this highlighted to me when I started looking into it is ethnicity is important because women of colour experience a different menopause. And that's what we need to realise. Whenever we have standards such as symptom scores or key questions that clinicians might ask, they always focus on wider population groups and often white women. But women of colour do experience a different menopause, and that is leading to some of the disparities we're seeing.
Let's just talk about that a little bit then, because we've talked in this season as well about how women present differently with heart attacks, for instance, you know, and how that is an area where the model is the male model. And so, you know, often it's a different, you know, a woman could be having a heart attack or in danger of having a heart attack, and it's not necessarily spotted either by her because she doesn't know what the how that presentation is, or, you know, by the medical world. So what are the differences for women of colour then when with their symptoms? How do they present differently?
That's a really interesting concept, and there's limited research done into this, but what we do have, and some of the areas I can talk about, are that there is something, first of all, a concept called allostatic overload.
Don't know what that is, but it sounds like a kind of catchy name. I've got allostatic overload.
It's that's such an important on. Concept for women when they're looking at their health, because it's not a way of saying, poor me, oh my God, my life's been so terrible, but this is science saying to us it's a cumulative effect of stressful experiences disabilities in your daily life alongside social disadvantage will lead to health problems, and menopause is one of them. So if you've had a tough life as a woman of colour, if you've had any degree of, and we've got to be careful, we're always generalising here, but any degree of limitation or a difficult puberty, perimenopause and pregnancy time, and alongside life events, that will lead to a harder health, and menopause is part of that. And what we do know from data from a SWAN study that's been carried out for many years is it takes longer for women from groups of colour to actually get their clinician to listen and also to join the dots of what might be happening to them. And menopause is definitely a blind spot in that area. There's lots of reasons for that. There could be conscious and unconscious bias. There could be differences in presentation. So we definitely know some groups will present less with hot flushes because of having a higher phytoestrogen diet and are more likely to have palpitations. So, for example, women from South Asian origin are more likely to have palpitations, body aches and urinary symptoms. So until they are only asked, do you have hot flashes, they will be saying no. And therefore, they're not menopausal. But we need somebody to join the dots and say, actually, this is what's happening. Same for women from Afro-Caribbean backgrounds. They're more likely to have body aches. And therefore, they will actually report tiredness, body aches, and go down a different route to thinking about menopause. But what we also find is a difference in language and medical illiteracy. Again, caution, mass generalising, but again, in South Asian languages, many of the words that we use for menopause description do not exist. So, for example, the word for ovaries is all related to period stopping and fertility. So right. When you ask a woman of South Asian origin about her periods, she'll be thinking, well, I don't want children anymore. Why are you even talking about that? So we need to put it in the context of some of your body aches, palpitations and urinary problems may well be happening because your ovaries are not working. And join those dots. And it becomes really, really important. In the Fawcett study showed 4,000 women, and 45% of women from Black and Asian groups said it took many appointments, 30% more than their white counterparts, to get their clinician to listen to them for menopause.
Yeah, I mean, it's depressing, isn't it? I don't know what I was hoping you might say with the reasons. Like, oh, it's okay if those are the reasons, that's fine. So you've got a situation where they're not being listened to, even if they are going to the doctors. They might not be going to the doctors because actually some of their other worries might be so much bigger that their aches and pains from menopause just aren't on their radar. And then the fact that the medical professionals aren't necessarily asking the right questions or joining the dots. So it's quite a comprehensive problem. I'm really interested that you mention phytoestrogens, just sidetracking a bit, because I also don't have hot flushes, and I also have a diet very high in phytoestrogens. I'm vegan, and naturally a lot of the foods I go to for my protein sources are high in phytoestrogens. Now, I didn't know I was having perimenopause. I was having heavier and more frequent periods rather than ceasing, so I didn't know anything about menopause. And obviously I've, you know, been on this journey for a few years now gleaning some information, but it keeps coming up, this business about phytoestrogen. And then people say, you know, doctors say, well, you'd have to eat so many phytoestrogens for it to really like have an impact on you, that actually eating phytoestrogen high foods probably isn't going to change your menopause presentation. But then you mentioned that, and I think, well, you know, it's a really interesting factor. And I know, you know, we're not here to talk about diet and menopause particularly today, but it does bring that to mind, that actually just a completely, you know, a different way of eating can have an overall impact.
Oh, totally. And I think that actually your lifestyle can have an enormous impact in your health benefits and the way you present. But one of the things with menopause is that we shouldn't oversimplify it. It's a very individual experience, and it's a spectrum. So you may not have hot flushes currently, but in 5 years' time, you may. It's about being in tune with your body. But yet, if you do reduce alcohol, if you do exercise, if you do eat healthier food, get natural light, sleep well in a cool room, you probably will have fewer hot flushes. Lots of things contribute to our health, and that's constantly changing. And we're learning more and more about that. And I think for me, the notion to cope myself as a woman as well is to not get overwhelmed with it, but keep making small changes and seeing how you feel. Check in with yourself. It's far less about doing what your friend is doing and more about listening to your body and seeing how you are. And we realize that even when women come to hormone replacement therapies, each of them is fairly individual in how they absorb, how they react to it. So we have to keep thinking about checking in. And this is where sort of continuity of care and having a clinician guide you and menopause not be so much of a letterbox service is really, really important.
It's really interesting that you mentioned, you know, don't do what your friends are doing. I think often that's really good advice for life generally. You know, like often, you know, my mum used to say to me, well, if your friend jumped off a cliff, would you jump off a cliff? But actually we are all doing what our friends are doing, aren't we? But also it's a difficult one in menopause because that can be the only place we feel we can go for information on it. You know, and especially in this subject we're talking about for non-white women, they've got to wade through an even deeper, thicker quagmire. Yeah. To get things they need. So we do go to our friends or Instagram or what celebrities are doing. And, and that is a good rich resource, I think. But it's really, I think what you say is really important to remember that this is your individual experience and what works for one woman might not work for you. And we're not very good at listening to our bodies, I don't think.
No, we're busy, aren't we? And we spend decades of our life looking after everybody else and less prioritizing ourselves, and it's a change. And I think that we have to view midlife as a crucial stage for health intervention and prevention of disease. And if we do that for all age groups, now women are brilliant at talking. That is one of our superpowers compared to men, is we actually share information. But what we want to do is grow with that information and go with signposting. And there's so much information out there. We are trying to improve and expand on the information available to women from different backgrounds. And the charity website can be translated and you can access the information. There are podcasts available that translate information. We're doing outreach work with different communities and also education work with clinicians in different areas. Some of the North and the Midlands areas, I'm working as a clinician with some groups to try and improve that awareness about particularly menopause and ethnicity. Because what data shows us for what we have is actually it's not all about ethnicity. Education can change the outcomes for different ethnic groups. And this is fundamentally important for our health system, because if we look at menopause as a transition where you're going to have an increased risk of obesity, lipid change, high blood pressure, glucose change, then actually the ethnic groups are actually at higher risk of that. And that's what we find, is that actually the practices tend to focus on diabetes, heart disease, hypertension or high blood pressure, and are not focusing on menopause because they have so much going on. Mm. But a little bit of it's a vicious cycle, because if you leave these women be, they will actually get worse. So we need to look at education really strongly. So, you know, communities are really important. Social media is a fundamental part of many women's lives, and the information on there can be very good. But as we all know, social media and media can be misleading. So it's about getting the right information. And unfortunately, it's, you know, it is all about flagging things up as they go along. But one thing, you know, women sharing information is definitely important, and taking away that taboo. A lot of communities have taboo and stigma attached to talking about women's health and menopause, you know, and it's something they wouldn't talk about. And, you know, I personally have seen very sad cases of a woman who are very young, early 50s, housebound with their genitourinary syndrome and urinary symptoms, and they're just getting on with it and staying indoors all the time. But that's not their only outcome. They can actually have a better quality of life, and we need to reach these women to know that's a possibility.
I was going to talk to you actually about taboo and stigma, because that is, you know, a recurring theme wherever you sit on the ethno scale, wherever you sit on the class scale. You know, I think people do think that menopause is something that happens to white middle class women, and, you know, women who are non-white and women who are not middle class are absolutely left by the side. But I think the stigma and the taboo possibly runs deeper there as well, you know, and some of it is about that not wanting to admit that you're struggling, you know, even if you don't know what you're struggling with. And then, of course, there's the taboo of menopause. Do you think that taboo is worse in certain communities for women of colour? And
yeah, it's there's several layers to it, isn't it? There's basically, the more we talk about something, as we're experiencing with our Meno revolution, the more we normalize it. So if you're in a culture that doesn't talk about, you know, if you're, for example, in South Asian culture, if you're on your period, you're dirty, you don't go to places of worship, and you don't interact with people as much as you would normally, or you have 40 days rest after having a baby to just sort of pull yourself back into one piece after having a delivery. A lot of these are a bit undertoned by staying away from people and not talking about these things. And, you know, it's sometimes I can remember when I was growing up, my mum would say with pride, your dad doesn't even know when you both are having periods. You know, that's not something to be proud of, because you're then actually struggling. And there's also the difference in language. There's a difference in openness. When women are together, they do talk, and they're doing that a lot more in ethnic groups. I definitely find women are more open about things, and I've certainly seen menopause being discussed in groups that I've been involved with a lot more. So we are changing that. But I think the other notion is that life is busy, and women of colour are generally not as established at prioritising and self-care. Making time for themselves will come later, and maybe their version of making time for themselves sometimes can be women sitting together and cooking, which may be enjoyable and really joyful for them, but it's not the same as going for a walk. So we need to change that, make it different, that they actually get their own health benefits from it. And certainly when it comes to examination, it can be difficulty in trying to see a male clinician, and, you know, or be open, or sometimes they can be very shut down by the way somebody responds to them. And I've certainly had women share their experience with me. For example, a woman who's having an intimate examination said to the doctor, "I feel numb and my body's not mine. I'm very uncomfortable." And the doctor just said, "It's just a normal consequence of aging." And she said, I felt so ashamed. You know, she took her several years to raise that again. And by the time I saw her, her genitourinary syndrome symptoms were much worse. But, you know, we need to have nurses or clinicians doing smears, picking this up and signposting, and work together as a team to sometimes repeat the same conversation 3-4 times in small snippets to keep that doorway open.
Urinary infections are just awful.
They really are. And I think that it's a really important point to pick there, because they're a very common event in women of colour, and they're often not joined the dots. They can be treated for recurrent UTI. But what enrages me to some extent with the educational process for training is the Urological Society and Gynecological Society guidelines for recurrent urinary infection, which is basically more than 2 a year.
Only 2 a year is
two a year
recurrent.
Is recurrent.
Wow.
So it says vaginal estrogen is part of the treatment. So this pathway, you know, lots of evidence has gone into creating this guideline. It exists, but there's something about its translation. And when I sat in this talk and heard this, I was like, why is everyone not doing this then? Because it's in the guidelines. And we're very good at following guidelines and sticking by guidelines usually. And we've got to work on education from the baseline, so from for public education, medical training education, and also all the health professionals that work alongside doctors, not just doctors alone, but there's, you know, the colleges need to listen and realize that the training needs to join up. What we have at the moment is a medical system that separates us into organs, and that doesn't work for your body for something like menopause, which affects you head to toe. You know, so you might go and see a neurologist for your brain fog, but we need him or her to have the baseline training to know that brain fog is part of menopause. If you see somebody for your body aches, we need to know that rheumatologist has the acumen to know this could be down to menopause. And that is starting to happen to some extent, and it affects all women, that it doesn't happen globally. Actually, this is still depriving and affecting all women to a huge extent, for the number of women that experience menopause, which basically is almost 99% of everyone who will be alive till 55, very small portion are actually getting that level of holistic care and explanation that they need. And it's not realistic to expect that from general practice alone. It needs to come from everybody. It needs to come from employers. It needs to come from community groups. It needs to come from social awareness and health groups. And it is starting to, but we have made tremendous progress in many ways, but we still lack the funding and the injection from our higher bodies and leaders to make this really happen.
Is that going to change? Is menopause getting pushed up the agenda as actually something that, because it just has so many bigger ripples? You know, you talked about workplaces, and we talk about this a lot. You know, it, the ripple out effect it has into society, from even women like me having the energy and the ability and the brain space to help look after my grandchildren so that my children can work, you know, even offering childcare and offering care for my elderly mum. All of that is impacted by my menopause symptoms. So is it getting better, that training? Is somebody taking a helicopter view of this?
Well, you'd hope so, wouldn't you? You'd really like them to. But I think that's, it's difficult. And I think that there's lots of different agendas and there's lots of different layers to this. So I guess to backtrack a little bit, awareness will feed demand and demand will feed change. It has to. And the time frame that's going to take is the variable really here. And the challenge with women's health and particularly menopause is it's never in those top priorities of our health system. So it has been cancer care, quite rightly, diabetes, dementia, cardiovascular disease, but these are the top consequences. So what we need is people to pop menopause into that and say, actually, this is, and we have had appointments of leaders that should be tackling this, but they claim to have done everything and fixed it and moved on. And, you know,
oh, great. We're yet to see. Isn't that great to hear?
Yeah. On paper, it's all hunky dory. But, the challenge is that, you know, every medical student school will have its teaching program. To be fair to GPs, they have a relentless job, and we have a real problem of lack of understanding of the full gravitas of that role and what is involved in doing head-to-toe care in a system that only gets a fraction of the budget but does most of the face-to-face or contact with patients. So, you know, the tiny, I think 7% of the NHS budget goes to general practice, yet 96% of the contact happens there with patients. So there's a huge disparity in what's being put in. So more resources are needed. But at the same time, in terms of GP training, I think it's unrealistic with how complicated we are and how long we live with multiple diseases to expect one human to be complete expert in everything. So what we really need is a model where you have, if you've got 50% of your population is female in your practice, you need a couple of female interest leads that will be able to take on the more complex cases. And thirdly, we also need to look at tertiary care, so hospital care. You know, this lack of menopause specialist clinics is a real problem. So in the Midlands is where my journey began in women's health, because I'd be doing A&E and women would come in with palpitations and chest pain. We'd do the normal spec on them, say, actually, your heart's fine, off you go. And no one would connect that they're 52, they've got body aches, they've got palpitation and chest pain, they're menopausal. Mm. And if those women had been given HRT, their metabolic risk would come right down.
Amazing.
And that connection wasn't made. So it's everybody that needs to be doing this. We can't just wait for general practice to pick this up. A&E needs to be going, here's a leaflet on menopause. Why don't you go and have a look at this? And actually that person who feels quite defeated going, oh, you're not having a heart attack, off you go home, actually feels like they've got some sort of plan. And it's really, really important. So there's so many different layers to this, isn't it? And I think the belligerent, the non-believers and the non-changers will not change, but many are.
It's interesting that you mentioned the lack of specialist menopause clinics. They're not in every area. And that has, I would imagine, driven up traffic to private menopause help, which is great if you can get it and you can afford it. You know, I understand even the waiting lists for that are very long now, you know. But what do you think about the one pay certificate for your HRT? So you're kind of just under £20 a year for everything. Do you think it'll make women who wouldn't necessarily think about HRT purely because of the cost come forward?
Yeah, I surely hope so. And I really do hope it does that. And I think from what I've heard so far, it's been really well received. And people are really pleased it's come out. And I am really pleased because I think it's a bit of a game changer for some women who were restricted by it, particularly when it comes to things like the combined patches where they were paying two prescription costs because there's two drugs in there. And, you know, that is a huge hit. And also when you look at the shortages, it meant they're getting smaller quantities. So once again, you're paying more frequently. If you're chopping and changing preparation because of shortages, you were trialing something, it didn't work, but you'd paid for that. And, you know, and I think that is in the cost of living crisis that we have at the moment and the financial difficulties people face, particularly in deprivation areas and, you know, lower socioeconomic groups. Cost is an enormous factor. So, you know, for some, still sadly, the one-off fee may be a restrictor. But hopefully it'll be less so than paying that constant fee or the annual prepayment that was far more. I think it's about £120. So, you know, you're paying far less. On average, your HRT for a year would cost about £120 to £200. Wow. So to have that for £20 is a brilliant change. So I'm really, really pleased about that. I think there are some wonderful positives coming out and that is up there with them.
Well, that's good. That's good to hear. I want to ask you a couple more things. You look very young, Radhika. you look far too young. I'm getting to that age where everyone looks really, oh, the doctors look like children. But you look far too young to be experiencing any menopause symptoms yourself. Are you perimenopausal? I mean, you look about 25.
No, I'm definitely not 25. My teenage is a testament to that. I'm perimenopausal, so I'm 45. And I think that one of the things we need to recognise is exactly that, is we don't need to wait till our periods stop. Mm. And that's a really important message to get out to all groups of women, is don't wait for your periods to stop, but look at the flags of sort of clues that you're getting. So if your periods are getting heavier or closer together or shorter, or you're missing them, definitely monitor your periods and track them. And if you find there's spells where you feel worse and it's just before your period, that's when your levels are really dropping. The other thing is, it's important to understand, periods are a marker of your womb lining shedding. And what your body will do is it will reduce your hormones around your body to try and keep your periods going.
That's like trees dropping leaves because they're trying to take all the power from the leaves to support the tree. That's amazing.
So our body is taking all the power from maybe your brain. So you're getting brain fog, forgetfulness, you know, low mood, you're feeling a bit out of sorts, loss of joy, but your periods are still coming reasonably regularly. That's because your body's reducing it all around your body and for that to keep going. So it's really important to look at those signs. And I think for me, the way my perimenopause journey came about was, I do find there's times of the month where I just generally ache more. I feel like I can exercise not as well as I could before. I get irritable, and definitely the change in cycles. And there's methods that we can use to support you during that stage. I don't need to wait till I'm 50 to be able to seek some help. And there's some brilliant methods that can help your menstrual cycle, life advice that you can get. So for me, exercise in the last 2 years has made an enormous difference to how I feel. It has been difficult to prioritize, but once you start doing it, the benefits pay off. And of course, eating well and reducing other toxins such as alcohol, smoking, and caffeine make an enormous difference. And for many women, where caffeine is an enormous social point of theirs, where they sit down and have a coffee, you just need to realise it's just not good for you and you need to reduce it.
Well, I went to decaf as soon as my, you know, peri symptoms got really bad, and that I can still enjoy a coffee. So you're so right about exercise. It's one of those things that's really hard to get going, isn't it? But once you make it a regular part of your life, I mean, no one ever comes back from a run and says, God, I wish I hadn't gone on that run.
Yeah. And you don't need to run. I mean, I have simple rules. I think, you know, any movement is good. And I say no shower until I've sweated to myself. So even if you're about to have a shower, run up and down your stairs 10 times. If you can, and movement and daylight and getting out and having that walk and talk with somebody, and also recognizing other sources of caffeine that you might not be aware of. So tea is quite high in caffeine, green tea contains caffeine, and obviously the stimulant drinks. These are the things that you really, you know, the sugar intake has a lot to do with it as well. And definitely I find in different cultural groups, there is a resistance to change in diet, but actually that is happening too. And lots of people are working towards that. And we need to be, there's no set formula that's unique to a particular ethnic group or group of women, and we need to consider on an individual basis. But certainly some women will find their absorption and their response to food or hormone replacement therapy differs according to their background and their health.
It's been great to have you on and chatting to us and sharing your insight, which is fantastic. So thank you, Dr. Radhika Bora, for coming on My Last Eggs today.
Thank you.
Thanks again to Dr. Radhika Bora. Fascinating conversation. To find out more, go to @dr.rvora on Instagram. And next week, we'll be talking to the CEO of the menopause charity, Jenny Haskey. Have a great week.